You are listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. My dear listeners, too much is happening too fast. I've been delaying and delaying recording because I'm very nervous about what the new thing is going to be that's going to happen for the first time just right when this show is released. It started with a terrorist attack in Beirut, and then the bombing of Dahiya and other poor Shia suburbs of Beirut. Then the killing of Nasrallah and other middle management of Hezbollah. And now an Israeli ground invasion of Lebanon is underway, as bombing and assassinating continues. This is very much Groundhog Day for Lebanon. It's Israel's third invasion of Lebanon, and despite some unusual tactical advantages, it doesn't seem to be going so differently from the last two. At least in southern Lebanon it isn't. But only time will tell, because things can change very quickly. But wait, there's more. Israel is so emboldened at this point, it may have attacked Iran for the third time before this show airs. Israel has had to work overtime to drag Iran into its vortex of genocidal destruction. Since October 7th, Israel has attacked Iran's sovereign soil twice, illegally, both for assassinations. Even so, Iran's default position towards Israel and the Arab Levant was initially to ignore both as much as possible, and then to do the bare minimum to deter Israel when ignoring them became impossible. Israel, however, is determined to have a war with Iran. This is how crazy everything's gotten. Israel may actually mark the anniversary of October 7th by pushing war on a country that had nothing to do with the Hamas attack, a country that has mostly tried to protect Israel from itself for over a year. As of this recording, Israel has continued its assassination campaign against Iran's military, a military that has mostly been focused on treating Israel with kid gloves. Since we're at a moment where we're just sitting around asking will they or won't they when it comes to Israel and Iran, I wanted to focus on Lebanon and a voice from Lebanon that, if you haven't heard her yet, you need to hear. It's a voice I go back to again, again, and again. And that voice is Hadi Francis. On September 25th, Brian Becker spoke with Hadi on his show, The Socialist Program. The episode was entitled, Why Lebanon Will Win. Hadi is a goat of Middle East journalism. She has done so much war correspondence and investigative journalism all over the Arab world. She has seen it all, and she has reported it all. Most important for us, she's Lebanese, born and raised in Lebanon. And unlike most Lebanese, she has lived in Lebanon her whole life, and she is there now. She represents a Lebanese that had been living with Israel and its aggression and occupation since 1948. Hadi brings amazing insight and perspective to this particularly volatile moment. She also does not mince words or sugarcoat anything. She is blunt and frank while also being insightful and thoughtful. This interview covers topics related to all that has happened up until September 25th, but whether she's talking about Lebanon, Israel, or Iran, or the United States, Hadi knows exactly of which she speaks. But again, it's her perspective and understanding of things that I find empowering and insightful at this moment, and I think you will too. We have so much to listen to. So yalla bina, let's go. Just one note before we start, I want to tell you about Brian Becker. Brian Becker is the founder and central organizer of the PSL, the Party for Socialism and Liberation. His show, The Socialist Program, is aligned with Breakthrough News, a major source of quality information and analysis on Palestine. I've certainly shared pieces from Breakthrough News here before, and I'm thrilled to share Brian's work here today. His framing of questions around liberation and colonialism is perfect for bringing out Hadi's most thoughtful perspectives on what she is seeing right now, and how she contextualizes things based on her expansive knowledge of and experiences in the region. And with that, here is Why Lebanon Will Win.
Welcome to the Socialist Program. I'm your host, Brian Becker. Today, we're talking with Gadi Francis. She is a Lebanese writer, a war correspondent, and a host of the TV show, The West Asia Post. Gadi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining. We have a lot to talk about. We want to talk about the current war, what's going on, where you are. You're in Beirut, you're in Lebanon, the prospects of a wider regional war. We want to talk with you about who is Hezbollah, because, of course, in the U.S. media, where sadly most Americans get their information, Hezbollah is a completely demonized entity. The U.S. describes it as a terrorist entity. We also want to talk about the history of U.S. and Israeli aggression against Lebanon. This is not, obviously, the first time. And the other thing we want to talk with you about is the enduring impact or factor of colonialism that has haunted Lebanon and the people in the Arab world and all the other peoples in the Middle East. So there's a great deal to talk about, but let's get started. This morning, Gadi, there's images on the front page of the New York Times of Israeli bulldozers going mile after mile after mile, knocking down homes and businesses in the West Bank. The same front page has images of Israeli bombs paid for by the United States dropping again on the people of Gaza. And of course, the carnage, as the Lebanese health minister has described it in Lebanon. So many have died. You're in Beirut. Just let's get started by helping Americans, especially, but we have a global audience, understand what's going on in Lebanon.
Thank you, Brian, for giving me the time to talk to Americans, especially those who have no idea what's happening in this part of the world. Today, the same media that you're talking about, the same mainstream American media and newspapers, shared that Americans or the American policymakers are concerned because Hezbollah hit a Mossad base around Tel Aviv that was responsible for a terrorist attack on 5,000 or more civilians, bystanders, Lebanese children, women, and non-combatants of Hezbollah last week. The same regime that massacred more than 400 Lebanese within 30 minutes. How do you think are we as people supposed to defend ourselves? We did not go anywhere. This is our land, our ancestors' land. We are here. And there are these kinds of terror attacks and massacres happening to our people. The response of the Lebanese resistance is to attack a Mossad base. And the Americans and their media is concerned over this attack on the Mossad base. And they did not tell you that the pager attack is a terror attack. It is against every human law and every Geneva Convention statement. And every single law demonizes and actually convicts people who attack civilians in daytime. They don't tell you about that, but they tell you they're concerned when a retaliatory strike hits military bases from Lebanon. Hezbollah, that demon, let's call them the demon. If they are demons, they have rockets that have proven their ability to attack anywhere they want, from Galilee, until today, they proven to Tel Aviv. So these rockets absolutely have the capacity to harm tens, maybe hundreds, and maybe thousands of so-called Israeli civilians if they wanted to. It's not a matter of what the Americans designate groups in the Middle East, because the credibility, sir, here is zero cubed. They told the world that they are coming from one side of the world to the other side of the world to invade Iraq based on a lie that Iraq has chemical weapons. They massacred a million Iraqis. They still did not show us what they actually did in Iraq and who did they deter. ISIS emerged just a few years afterwards. All kinds of terrorism stayed in Iraq after the presence and after the American invasion, after the American price, because people died in that invasion. Americans paid, taxpayers suffered because of that invasion. So when you tell me about the designations and what the American policy says about groups in the Middle East, These are the same people who could do a pager attack to every ISIS terrorist in the Middle East, sir. They did not. They could cover that. They do not. But they cover killing our children. You have seen the countless faces of children, of little girls and boys, of families who have been massacred in that so-called supremacy of technological warfare and that terror attack on Lebanon. And audaciously, the mainstream media glorifies that. What if that happens in anywhere else other than Beirut? Imagine that happening in Paris or Norway or America or Canada or New Zealand or to any different kind of native indigenous people. What would that mainstream media do? They are still justifying all these massacres over a lie on one day in occupied Palestine called the October 7 mass rapes. It has been debunked. Babies beheaded. There are no babies, no names, no pictures. Tens of Palestinians' babies have been beheaded over that lie, and they're still carrying it and repeating it. So I think it is time that the American population thinks beyond that mainstream brainwash of a media. And tell me, as a Lebanese person, I'm not a Hezbollah person. Tell me, how am I supposed to defend my children from an F-35 or an F-16 or a technological cyber warfare that has all kinds of impunity from the world? Am I supposed to sit? They expect us to sit down and wait for our death? Well, some of us do in Lebanon, actually. They chose to give up, but some of us, especially the people of South Lebanon and Bekaa and West Bekaa, these people have been front, face to face with the Israeli oppression all these decades, year in, year out. They have chosen to stand their ground because they have paid so much blood, so many years. They have built and rebuilt their homes many times. So right now, they're not going to stand back, and they want to fight back. Their choice is to kill army leaders and military leaders and intelligence leaders of that so-called army that's massacring their civilians. So you tell me, who's the demon here? And what do you expect them to do? To shut up and die in silence? Well, too bad, they don't want to. They want to fight until their last breath, and they're doing it.
Let me ask you a follow-up question there, Gadi, and thank you for that. The U.S. media was saturated with headlines just like you described. They talked about the technological prowess of the Israelis blowing up all these people simultaneously in the middle of the afternoon by having planted explosives in their communication devices. So the headlines were like a tactical success for Israel, but what's the strategic value? Or Israel demonstrates Hezbollah's weakness, kind of like a boasting, a bragging, a conceit. Hezbollah has been wounded. Senior leaders in Hezbollah have been assassinated. Not as if that's correct to be able to carry out targeted assassinations of people in another country, just that it happened and that it was successful. So it's been completely interpreted without any emotive outrage, any sort of disgust. It's very dispassionate, very passive, very clinical. And at the same time, the implication of the coverage is that Hezbollah is so weakened that Israel can basically do with Lebanon what it wants. I mean, that's basically the through line on this. And of course, it is a loss for Hezbollah to have senior leaders assassinated like this. Obviously, that's something that any military force or resistance force would have to take into account. But then I'm looking at the media today, Gadi, and the New York Times again says, well, Israel has called up two reserve brigades. Now, a brigade is like 2,000 to 4,000 Israeli reservists. So the implication there is that Israel is now ready to have, in addition to this air war against the people of Lebanon, a ground invasion, as they did, you know, after the 1982 war, the Israeli aggression against Lebanon and Beirut. And then I'm thinking, well, wait, yeah, Hezbollah has taken some losses, but there must be 100,000 fighters in Hezbollah, if you're fighting on Lebanese territory, America learned in Vietnam, having the best missiles won't necessarily defeat a guerrilla army on the ground when it's in its country. Anyway, I want to get your thoughts about this and help people understand what the mood, not just the mood in Lebanon, but the capacity of resistance forces in Lebanon to actually fight.
Well, this is going to be amusing. You know, it's all wrong. Even if they want to boast and glorify this kind of killing people, to start with your question from the first idea, it's wrong. And even if they want to sell it as a loss, a tactical loss for Hezbollah, it's wrong. Because you did not harm his combatants. You harmed people in the middle of the day. They were in supermarkets or their homes. The people who are actually firing the rockets were not the people harmed in the pagers. They're busy doing other things with their hands and their eyes in the middle of the day. Okay? Number two, they are 100,000. And on that day, when they carried this terror attack, the other 100,000 of people pro-Hezbollah that were tired were adrenalized in a way. They were all ready to fight back. And you could see everybody who was tired and asking, do I really want to go into a solidarity war with Gaza, has now a personal vengeance with the Israelis. On another tactical win for Hezbollah, the Lebanese differences in politics had people divided, way too divided. On the day when you attack children in Lebanon, every Lebanese, Christian, Sunni, Shia, Durzi, left, right, and center, was donating blood. Some people went into donating their eyes. Do you imagine the kind of national solidarity that takes tens of people to send their phone numbers and stand at the doors of hospitals saying, I am here to give one of my eyes to a Hezbollah fighter because he's going to do better with it. He's going to defend my country more with it. How are you harming Hezbollah when you're not harming him militarily wise? And tactically as well, you just told every person in the world that's carrying any kind of technological device that they are a target, and it's okay to kill them. If it's the Israelis doing that today and you're considering it a win, who says that nobody else would enter the competition and other groups and armies want to show that they are superior in massacres even more than the Israelis, and they would utilize this everywhere? This is not superiority to it doesn't take strength or more power to booby trap technological devices. It just takes more criminality inside you. We do not carry these kinds of attacks because we do not want to kill people. We want to defend our homes from invaders. But invaders do carry these attacks. I take you to the other to the other side. When we talk about assassinations, the problem with the Israelis, I mean, I'm happy they have this problem because this is why they're not going to win. The problem with this part is that they think within their tools and their dictionary about their enemies. They think that in Hezbollah, assassinations really shake up the organization because they really don't understand, or really they underrate that ideology. I mean, those people's boss, ideologically, Imam Ali was killed. Imam Hassan, son of Ali, was killed. Imam Hussein, brother of Hassan, was killed. Imam Zain al-Abidin was killed. All their imams, all their leaders are martyrs. And this is like the best thing you can do to a leader is to kill him. Because they breed many of such leaders. Ibrahim Aqil was able, in the 40 years that he outlived the Americans wanting to kill him. And that's 40 years since the 80s, the Americans wanted to kill him. In 40 years of his life, he was able to make countless Ibrahim Aqils in that organization. And so did all the leaders that they have assassinated. They have outlived the Israelis wanting to assassinate them for 40 years. These are people who are carrying the targets on their backs and on their heads. And that cyber intelligence, filthy warfare for decades. It's only reasonable for them to be assassinated. It doesn't make Hezb lose. I'm not selling you lies here or bluffing. I mean, Imad Mughniyeh was martyred. the brain of everything was martyred in 2008. Did you see Hezbollah fail in the war against ISIS in Syria? Legendary wins. Did you see Hezbollah get limited or really expand? They are in Iraq, they are in Yemen, and the influence in the alliance in the region, they grew. Assassinations never stopped them. And when we talk about the technological capacity, I'm a journalist that has reported from a place called the Iranian Silicon Valley that is made by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the presidency of Rouhani. I was invited to Tehran as a journalist and I saw it. Nanotechnology, stem cell technology, all kinds of AI technology. I don't think that the cyber warfare is something very far or unattainable for these groups. And I think the proof is that they were able to intercept to surpass the Iron Dome many times. And they were able to send drones that took footage inside the territories for hours, long footage, and to come back safely to Lebanon. This is a breach. And also you cannot really compare the strength of a horse to the strength of a duck, for example. Are you really actively comparing $1 billion funded and supported army weaponized state rogue regime called Israel to a population kind of resistance that is working under sanctions and it's not even a state or an army? Are we really? I mean, you have to measure each one as per their capacities and who they are. So this is why I think the attacks did not help them. And you don't need to go back to the Vietnam analogy that you gave, sir. You can go back just 18 years ago in 2006. I will tell everyone that is listening to this podcast and watching this stream that in 2006, us, the Lebanese people, we saw the same things. We saw the southern people, the southern population getting displaced. We opened our homes. We sat with our fellow countrymen and women for 33 days. In the first 20 days, we thought we're going to lose everything. And then when we are about to lose hope in the middle of the ground invasion, we flipped the measures. We won. We kicked them out. And we got back our prisoners. We succeeded in all our objectives. And the people of the South went back to the South and they rebuilt their homes and they got married and they made new fighters. And some of the fighters who were born after that war today are fighting the Israelis and they are waiting for another ground invasion, because one of the strongest points of this resistance is when the Israelis actually enter the ground. The last idea I have to give you is a precedent. The last time that Sayyid Nasrallah spoke to the Lebanese and the world, and the Israelis, in his last speech, he spoke about the possibilities of ground invasion, and he actually invited the Israelis. He told them, you could come and enter, and we could go on for months and months, and we would make you bleed nonstop as military, as army, as death, as operations in southern Lebanon. I don't think the problem here, if they get 200,000 reservists, not only 2,000 or 4,000, because on the other side of the scale, you have tens of thousands of Iraqis. Al-Marja'iyya Sistani, the highest spiritual leader in Iraq, already said for all the Iraqis, go and fight in solidarity with your fellow brothers in Hezbollah. The Yemenis, the Syrians, the Iranians. And they're not reservists, but I'm telling you, their ideology is not to be underrated at all.
I think it's important for people to really hear your message. And Gadi, you made the point that you're not Hezbollah. You're not a Hezbollah member. You're a journalist. You're a Lebanese person. So your assessment of Hezbollah, your assessment of the other fighters in the region, of their capacity, their steadfastness, their resilience, their readiness to fight, it's based on an objective assessment. You're not speaking outside of this sort of capacity as a journalist and as a Lebanese person to evaluate the reality. And I think that's really important for people in the United States, because, again, and the reason I'm mentioning this is that anybody who says anything in the United States, even of an objective character about Hezbollah, its capacity, how it's viewed in a favorable light by other Lebanese people. They are not just demonized, but they're targeted because the U.S. government, using this terrorist label, which is completely political, it has nothing to do with facts. It's a political designation. They use it in order to, one, demonize people, discredit people, or to criminally prosecute people. So what I think is so important for the U.S. audience is to understand, people in the United States don't understand because they're getting their information from the American media, that Hezbollah is a key part of the fabric, the heart and soul of Lebanese society. And it's regardless of ideology or religion, because, of course, there are different religions in Lebanon. This understanding that Lebanon's life is at stake. There's an existential issue facing all people in Lebanon, and all of the resistance forces, including Hezbollah, will be regarded as people defending the nation. And, you know, you mentioned 2006 when Israel failed to win in Lebanon. That was a strategic defeat. They were driven from Lebanon in 2000 after armed resistance, guerrilla resistance by the people in the south in the aftermath of the 1982 Israeli invasion of Beirut. This is an essential element of what it means to be Lebanese, it would seem to me, at this stage in history. And again, I want people in the United States to get it, to understand it. And it's very hard for them to get it if they're not there and if all their information is filtered through a media which is really functioning as an echo chamber both for the U.S. military-industrial complex and for the Israeli regime. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, it's at that point into the struggle and the fight, you feel like you don't really want, it's really frustrating to have to explain, like for a big part of your time, to explain that you are an equal human and that you deserve the same rights, and to like say, no, I'm not Hezbollah, listen to me, I'm saying facts. I mean, what if? Who says who's right and who's wrong? If I want to speak about my faith, I am a Christian. If I want to speak about my politics, I'm a secular. I'm not into religion, into politics. So basically, there's nothing in me that can be a Hezbollah person. But on the day when the Israeli warplanes are attacking the children of my country, I am all for defending them. This is exactly the sentiment of every Lebanese, regardless of their views. And the thing is, I really invite the Americans that are to be open-minded, that are listening to me today, to be open-minded. And let's think together if we really want to deter this force that is called Hezbollah. Is lying about it going to help us? Is demonizing it going to help us? Or rather, to try to expand our brains and try to understand why it is gaining popularity within these people. If you want to deter the Iranian expansion in the Middle East, you started your sanctions, dear West, in 1979. Ever since you started sanctioning Iran, it started growing in the Middle East. Don't you see that your sanctions aren't working? Don't you see that they're growing more popular in terms of popularity and influence among their people and their region? Why? Because the echo chamber doesn't work on our population. It might work on your population and your voters. It doesn't work on our population. And the more of the hegemony is in power here, the more the people would resist, because nobody wants to live without a dignity, and they have to understand. When you spoke about the guerrilla fights during the 80s, giving more context into that, and thank you for reminding me to talk about it, they were from all sects, sir. There were Lebanese Christian women, Norma Abi Hassan. Go and Google her. Look at her face and her attire. Lola Aboud, Sana Mhaidli. Look at these women who, during the mid-80s, went with their bare bodies and fought till death. There was no Hezbollah involved in these attacks. There was no Islamist involved. There were communists doing the same. There were nationalists doing the same, seculars, atheists. It wasn't, the fight wasn't with Islamists, if we want to take it into that concern. If the Americans or the American policymakers really want to defeat Hezbollah, it doesn't happen by denying the facts. Will the Israelis win in a ground invasion? The facts say that they never were able. Will Hezbollah be defeated? In the precedent, since its birth till today, they have never lost any battle. Not in Syria, not in Lebanon, not against the Israelis, not against ISIS. They have proven in every, like, we're talking about people who have won all their matches. So underestimating them will not change the idea. Speaking about the popularity, because you mentioned that in your great monologue here, there are the most voted MP in the 128 members of parliament in Lebanon. The one with the highest votes, got more than 50,000 votes, is called Mohammad Raad. He is the head of the Hezbollah bloc in the Lebanese parliament. His son was killed in the beginning of this war in a direct missile to assassinate him, because his son is a fighter in a Ridwan force, a leader, actually. He's an MP, and his son is a leader. And he got voted by the most amount of Lebanese people. When you justify demonizing Hezbollah like that, you are justifying slaughtering 50,000 Lebanese people who voted for these people to represent them. And this is textbook genocide. So when you are demonizing a population that chose something, you are saying it is okay to kill them all. And you're actually doing that in your mainstream media. And we know it. I hope the American taxpayers and voters understand it from our prerogative, from our perspective. I want to tell you, we are not radicals who hate the West and want to go live under a tree. We are educated, civilized people coming from the melting pot of cultures. We all have extended families all around the world. Some of us actually do carry the American passports as we speak our minds like that. Do you know how many Lebanese Shia are American voters? I bet that the parties and the running candidates do know. They don't care about the Arab or the Muslim vote in America. And this is something I don't really understand to articulate. But I'm telling you, Hezbollah is an idea. You cannot kill the idea. You can try, but you don't succeed. You've been trying for more than 40 years. It's time you learn. And maybe you change the strategy and you listen to the voice of the land. You want them to like Hezbollah less. Give them other options. Don't tell them you're going to kill them for that.
Let's talk about why or the motivations, if you have any thoughts on this, of the Israeli regime in terms of expanding the war. Israel has succeeded at killing a lot of people in Gaza, but they have not wiped out Hamas. So far, they have not succeeded militarily in spite of the almost year-long bombardment of this very tiny territory. It's only 5 miles wide, 25 miles long. So this concentrated offensive against Gaza has not succeeded except in killing so many people. The Israelis are bulldozing big parts of the West Bank. I mean, literally bulldozing homes and businesses. Now they've expanded the war to Lebanon, and Hezbollah, obviously, Lebanon is not Gaza. Hezbollah is not Hamas. It's a bigger country, much bigger, and Hezbollah's military capacity is much greater. So the question is why? What's the goal? There's articles appearing in some of the U.S. media in the last couple of days where there's a lot of speculation about this, that Netanyahu, having failed really in Gaza, is now one either trying to provoke a larger regional war that will draw the U.S. in as its principal ally, because essentially, at the bottom line, is Israel must be viewed as an extension of American power, because without which it doesn't really succeed at all. Or secondly, here's another notion, and again, this is speculation, but I want to get your thoughts. That Netanyahu is really trying to make an extended war in Lebanon so that there won't be a ceasefire and that this will work against the Kamala Harris's election prospects, and that should Trump be elected, Trump is so militantly for Netanyahu that the new American administration, no matter what Netanyahu's failures are so far, that they will be rescued more decidedly by a Trump administration. So anyway, these are speculations, but that's not out of bounds. In other words, this is Netanyahu's October surprise, so to speak, in terms of trying to impact and influence the outcome of the U.S. election in November. Again, another notion. Your thoughts?
Well, sir, I do respect my capacity. I cannot really understand or articulate about the very sick and dirty relationship between the Israeli Zionist lobbies and the AIPAC and the policymakers in the United States. This is something I don't even allow myself to try to analyze because it's too complicated, it's too intertwined. And really, the speculations could all be correct for all I know. I don't understand because as per the American media, there's like $58 million that the AIPAC paid to American Congress people to speak pro-Israel or for that lobby. So, I mean, they're actually actively bribing politicians. So I don't really find it very unlikely if they try to do more. And I don't understand. At some point, I thought that Israel is an American colony in the Middle East. But when you see these things happening, you think maybe no, maybe the Zionists already hijacked America as well. And we need to work together to liberate the American people, sir, and the American politicians, if this is the case. So I will let myself and allow myself to analyze the things I know about. And that's my region. Allow me to talk about Netanyahu's failures in Gaza, failures to come in Lebanon, and why he's doing that. I think because he has zero success in Gaza, because he failed to eradicate Hamas, he failed to free hostages, he failed to silence the Israeli anger at him, he has a disrupted internal policy, a disrupted military and security ranks, a disrupted government, a disrupted parliament, and he's living an existential war. You want to ask me why Netanyahu is leading this war? I want to ask you, what is Netanyahu tomorrow if there's no war? He's fighting for his own personal salvation. And I want to remind everyone, where is Ehud Olmert, the last president that led war anti-Lebanon? He went to jail for a few years, right? Inside Israel. The Israelis will eat Netanyahu alive if there is no war, because he didn't bring them any kind of success. He didn't deliver anything in Gaza. So I think, I suppose he told himself, maybe I can get them a win in Lebanon. Let me try and sell a win in Lebanon. And this is what you see in the way the warmongering and the mainstream media happens even as the attack is happening. The pager attack, the terrorist attack, they try to sell it as a big win for Netanyahu. Assassinating 70-year-old leader in Hezbollah, that is very important, but Hezbollah has many leaders. They sell it as the end of Hezbollah, and their media says, like, Nasrallah is alone. Nasrallah has 100,000 fighters, ya Habibi. If you kill 9,900, you know, per day, you need 10 days to kill them all. I mean, what are you talking about? So they're trying to sell these wins because they're looking left, right, and center to play on the time. This is why you see Netanyahu trying to drag Iran into that war. Because the best case scenario for him is that if all the West, the Americans and the NATO and everybody's fighting Iran, the Israelis will be busy with that. They will not eat him alive. And that's a great exit for him. I want to tell you, he will lose everything. Not because the ICJ ruled that he's a war criminal. Not because the UN told him to stop countless times. Not because the US will tell him stop massacring and slaughtering the people of the Middle East. They don't care about us. He will lose because of the rockets that will shower the Israeli people that are already angry. It would be one of two. They either take him down or they all go down together. Because yesterday, Iraq was sending rockets and drones, Yemen, and Lebanon. And as per the army and all the footage that has been exposed about Hezbollah's capacity in the past years, they still have countless, tremendous, diverse kinds of missiles and rockets that they didn't use. They still did not, what still did not enter the battlefield are the directed missiles. They're still like showering targets like that. And one thing that to talk about analyzing the coming war with the Israelis in Lebanon, you look at 2006, something Nasrallah is a master in. The Israelis say that. And the world knows it by now. He's a master of psychological warfare, and he's a master of his people. He understands them very well. And when they are feeling really down after the displacement, he went on the phone. The Israelis were winning everything. So they said, we assassinated Nasrallah in 2006. He called up Al Jazeera on a phone to tell his people that he's not assassinated. But he didn't call them empty-handed. You know what he did? He introduced a new rocket called Zilzal, earthquake. And he fired at the actual boat in the sea that was firing, southern suburb of Beirut. And he was like, let me ring Al Jazeera. Hello, I'm alive. Dear people, this ship that was attacking you and killing your families is now burning, and on it, tens of Israeli soldiers. Okay, goodbye. And he shut that phone. He left it till the last days of the war. He had it back in the closet. So I don't think Nasrallah, 18 years later, doesn't have a lot of surprises in his closet.
No. Let's talk about the history here a little bit. The Israelis invaded Egypt in 1956, along with the British and the French. The Israelis carried out the June 1967 war against Egypt and Syria. Jordan, it's when the Israelis seized the West Bank and Gaza and Golan Heights. There was the 1982 invasion of Lebanon that started also in June 1982. And then there was the Sabra and Shatila massacres mid-September 1982 in the Palestinian refugee camps. There was the occupation of the southern part of Lebanon then for the next 18 years until armed resistance forces drove the Israelis out in 2000. Then there's the 2006 war that you talked about. I mean, this is a tremendous track record of basically routine, regular, or what might one might call endless war, and that Israel is a warfare state. But so much has changed now, Gadi. I mean, what you're talking about in terms of other resistance forces in the region who are not necessarily state actors, but who are there and have formidable forces in Iraq or Syria or Iran or Lebanon, and certainly in Palestine. There's also global public opinion, including U.S. public opinion, which has now changed. I mean, last night, in New York City, thousands of people were in the streets saying, hands off Lebanon, stop the U.S.-Israeli aggression against Lebanon. That was like instantaneous last night. There will be more protests, and there were protests all around the country, by the way. It was a national day of action here in the United States. In the last 11 months, we've been organizing demonstrations in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza. On November 4th, we had 500,000 people in Washington, D.C., and then another almost the same size January 13th. And then when Netanyahu came on July 24th, thousands of people were in the street. So his whole, I mean, if you were in Washington, D.C. on July 24th, we called it Fort Netanyahu because the U.S. Capitol was completely surrounded with military police forces to defend this foreign leader as he addressed disgracefully both houses of the U.S. Congress. But the American people were in the streets. So there's this changed nature of the world compared to, say, 56 or 67 or 82 or even 2006, where the relationship of forces in the Middle East has changed. And also global public opinion has changed, including, again, in the United States. Global opinion isn't the same as having an army, but it's not nothing either. It's not something that can be disregarded. In fact, under some circumstances, public opinion can become like the tipping point or a decisive element, along with many other factors. So when you look at the whole picture here, even though it's not hundreds or thousands of Israelis dying, it's the most of the dying is in Lebanon or in Gaza or in the West Bank. Nonetheless, the relationship of forces on these different platforms or different tiers, when you look at the big picture and think like, okay, what's going to happen in 10 years? The people in Lebanon are not going anywhere. They live there. It's their country. Same with the people in Palestine. But the Israelis, as a settler population, a lot of them have second passports. A lot of them actually can leave. It just seems to me that this is the beginning of the end of the Israeli Zionist project, even though on its face it doesn't seem so, unless one takes a historical perspective. Anyway, that's my thoughts. I want to get your reaction.
I think many of the Israelis share your thoughts. Many of the intellectuals and the historians, the actual Israeli historians, and some of the descendants of Holocaust survivors have voiced these concerns. And they said the way that Israel is acting, it's not only self-destructive, it is actually destroying the future of the Jews in the world because it's committing all these crimes in the name of the Jews. This is why you can see people like Dr. Gabor Mate, people like Medea Benjamin, people who are actively always saying that I'm doing that for my Jewish legacy, for my Jewish ancestors, because this is not what we stand for. Regardless, these protests are very important. And I always reiterate that our alliance may not have the global north, but it has the global north future, the youth of these countries, the youth of America, the youth of the United Kingdom, the youth of Europe has emerged in the streets and said it. But also we have to say that it's not only protesting. Sometimes the actual action needs to happen. Disruption needs to happen. The boycott needs to happen and be really harming and vocal. Because regardless of all your protests, Benjamin Netanyahu took 52 standing ovations that day in his fortress of voted congressmen and women that you voted for. I mean, if you do not have the choice for the third party in your presidency elections, at least change your Congress. At least do something. I don't disrupt something. Change the course of that history to be less complicit as taxpayers. You know, this is your call. I mean, it's. When you talk about the, I'm so glad that you can see it with this emotionless view, because many of the people in our region do not see it like that, that the end is near and that the liberation is near, because they have been so blinded by the idea of the Western supremacy. And they, too, have been brainwashed. You have some people who are like giving up since the beginning and the emergence of this struggle. People who want to like give up. I don't want to fight with the strong white people. Give them whatever they want and just let's make peace. But this notion did not work. Even when there were some people who tried to make peace with them, they did not stop being an apartheid regime. We could see how they are treating the Arab Israelis inside Israel. So this is not a lie that anyone would believe. I think in the future, this what's happening in this region, sir, is just the idea that truth always prevails. In the beginning of the 20th century, the colonial powers, the global Western colonial powers, who won over the Ottoman Empire, took this piece of land that the Ottoman Empire was occupying as well. This piece of land, this greater natural Levant, is not Arabia, it's not the Gulf. It is Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine. This stretch of land has always been unified. The French and the British cut it out and they started the idea, the Zionist entity inside Palestine. They cut it out into Iraq, Syria, to divide and conquer Lebanon. And now, a century later, truth prevailed. The people are stretching like one body from southern Lebanon, passing through Golan, to Jordan, to Iraq, and going down and forming a circle from Yemen up towards Palestine again. The people are the people. They're being oppressed together. They're being killed together. And after a century, they're now fighting together and they're unifying their bond. Because the Zionist entity was man-made, but that nation was born like that. So whatever you do, no matter how much you pay, I'm not going to stop being Lebanese. I'm not going to stop looking like my sister from Beit Lahem, whose settlers are taking her father's land today. I'm not going to stop looking and feeling exactly like my sister from Gaza, who's sleeping in a tent today. I'm not going to lose that fight. And now, after the new resurfacing massacres, they saved us time, sir. We were going to spend years and hours educating our children to be pro-liberation, anti-Israel, because everything was being mixed and normalization and the ideas of globalization. They served us really well by showing all our people their real face and telling our kids to fight even if we're gone. So they're just like recruiting more and more liberation rebels within our communities. I mean, I can't stop my 8-year-old niece from asking all sorts of questions about this war because she's seeing that she cannot go to school. And every time she asks me, I take her back to the idea that this is our land and we will not leave because we're not really scared. Because what is life if you're not coming from a free land? What is freedom if your land is not free? What kind of life is it? This is why I want to salute all my Lebanese sisters and brothers who you mentioned, who are calling for the national action, the American Lebanese, the French Lebanese, the Lebanese holding the dual passports, have their hearts beating wherever they are. And they are a very big support system to their communities inside homeland. And all their life, they spend all their life abroad just to plant a tree back home and to come back. Whereas these settlers, the settler community that you described, they come because it's cheaper. They come because they have no other places where they can be like spoiled like that, to be given a tube to live in someone else's land. But when it's a matter of life and death, nobody fights for stealing. Nobody wants to die for stealing. But for us, we would die to defend our kids. We have no other choice.
Gadi, as we move towards the close here, I want to bring up, we did it a little bit while you were speaking just now. There are two maps that I have. They're what we call the Sykes-Picot maps, and it's of the countries you talked about, and there's one of them. And just again, for our audience that might not know, at the end of World War I, actually before the end, the victors in World War I, particularly the British and the French, and earlier it was Tsarist Russia, but then the Russian Tsar was overthrown by a revolution, and the Bolsheviks actually published the Sykes-Picot Treaty and denounced secret diplomacy. But there was a secret agreement made between the British and French imperialists to divide up Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, the entire region, all the countries that you see there. Britain will take this and France will take that. In other words, they said that World War I, in the words of Woodrow Wilson, was a war to end all wars or a war for democracy. But in fact, this was the beginning of a new war because it was the colonial imposed system, a new colonial imposed system on the Arab people in this region. And the irony, as you said, Gadi, is so amazing when you think about this imperialist colonial division of those lands and those and that people. Here we are 100 years later, almost. Sykes-Picot was 1916. We're 108 years later. That struggle hasn't stopped. It's gone through different stages and phases and iterations, but it's basically the same struggle. And now the people who have been the colonized people, in spite of divisions, in spite of being in different countries that are now legal entities with different flags and membership at the UN, they're fighting more and more as one people against imperialism and colonialism. And I would say the Israelis, as an extension of that colonialism, retain the same sort of social composition, social political composition, the desire to dominate these people in these lands. Anyway, when you think of it in the big picture, in a historical perspective, you can see that, as Martin Luther King said, the arc of the universe is long, but it tends to bend in the direction of justice. It bends in the direction of justice because people don't want to live under foreign occupation. They want to be, as you said, free people. Anyway, with that said, I'll give you the last word.
I'm so happy that you showed this map, sir, because it's actually what I'm always trying to tell everyone. Sykes and Pico are a British man and a French man. This says it all. They sat down, and this is, and by the way, I'm reading now a book I would advise anyone else to read. It's like The Roots of Christian Zionism. It's a little bit of papers before the Balfour Promise, and it tells you even the context that is deeper into when they really started to plant the Zionist thing in the world and how it's all coming from the West and it's all colonial and it's nothing about religion, actually. They made up a story to drive people inside that way. So I would also advise people to read A Peace to End All Peace. That's a very great response to that war to end all wars idea that you gave. And I want to give you one more piece of information given that era. In 1916, when the Sykes-Picot was happening, in the same era, King Crane, the Americans did a good thing at that point. There was no hegemony. The hegemony was French and British at the time. So the Americans sent the King Crane to ask people what do they want. And it's like a referendum at that point before actually making these big decisions on behalf of these people. And most of the people told that, according to that statistics, that was the Red Cross, and you can go see the King Crane Commission. So people said the actual result of that study led by King Crane was that this division would lead to endless wars, famines, and migrations. And for the past century, for the 108 years, sir, this was the case. It's always wars here. It's always migration here. And there are always problems and famines. But I don't think Sykes and Picot will be very happy when they see that Kata'ib Hezbollah from Iraq are firing rockets that are flying over Jordan, Syria, Golan, hitting occupied Palestine in solidarity with their Lebanese brothers in southern Lebanon, who previously fought in Aleppo, northern Syria, against ISIS. So this stretch of blood and stretch of fight in terms of the people, when you die in Iraq, you're Lebanese, you die in Iraq, you're Yemeni, you want to fight for Palestine. You are unifying this land. You are stepping over the era of Sykes and Picot, you know, and I think we only have the choice of believing in our causes and in our people and in our nations and for all the costs that have been put, for all the innocent blood that has been shed in this land, for all the injustice, the prisoners without any crimes, the rape people in the prisons, for all the atrocities that are being made and recorded and televised, for making dogs criminals that attack and rape humans, for making technology a war blast device, for all the humans that are in danger in front of these atrocities, for everything that this is telling you, we will win.
Gadi Francis, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me.
We are out of time. Thank you so much, Gadi Francis, Brian Becker, everyone who is working so hard to keep up this incredibly difficult fight. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. We thank you so much for spending your time with us today as we all continue to work very hard towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week. Thank you.